Okay, Robert Zimmerman has decided to stick around for another hour to take your calls. That's very gracious of him, so let's take advantage of his time and do so when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. Robert, do you remember the plight of Apollo 13? Just an incredible story, wasn't it?
Remember, I wrote Apollo 8, Genesis story, Apollo 8.
Great story.
But, you know, that's available still as an e-book. It's never been out of print since it came out in 98. And Apollo 13, Jim Lovell was on both missions. And when I was interviewing Jim Lovell about Apollo 8, he talked a little bit about 13 with me. He talked about how the movie, it was interesting. He got the first draft of the script, and he called up Ron Howard, the director, and he told him, that's garbage. You really, it stinks. I don't want you to do it. But what I'll do is I'm going to mail you the actual transcripts of the mission. You know, they recorded everything, and they made transcripts of it. That's what I used when I was writing about Apollo 8.
Yeah.
And he sent those to Ron Howard and says, look, read those. There's a real story here. It really happened. And Ron Howard had the sense to read that and said, you know, you're right. Let's, instead of creating fake stories, things like that didn't happen, let's tell the real story. And the result was a really great movie that captured very effectively the heroic nature of not so much the astronauts, not to take anything away from them, but the heroic nature of the engineers on the ground.
Oh, my gosh. And they must have broken down and sobbed when they knew that those astronauts were safe.
Yes. Oh, yes. But it was designed. The achievement was made even before the rocket took off, because they designed the mission with all these contingencies in the background, so that if something went wrong, they could cover it. What I like to talk about between Apollo 8 and Apollo 13, Apollo 13 was using the whole system properly. It had the Apollo capsule and its service module, but it also had the lunar module and its supplies, and they acted as a redundancy to each other, and that's exactly how it worked. When the Apollo capsule service module exploded, had an explosion, and they lost its capacity, they turned around and opened up the lunar module, and that became the lifeboat to get them home. It was designed to work that way. And what's interesting about the Apollo 8 mission, which occurred just a few years earlier, and that was the very first time we went around the moon, they did not have the lunar module. So if the same thing had happened to Jim Lovell, if the same thing had happened in Apollo 8, he would have died in 5 minutes, and there would have been no recovery. So in that sense, it just strikes home more forcefully how risky the Apollo 8 mission was and how significant its success was in 1968 to win the space race to the moon, as well as to demonstrate American capabilities.
All right, back to the calls now we go as they lined up. Some people have been waiting an hour. Sedona, Arizona, Richard's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Richard.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question. I remember as a kid just being fascinated by the photos of the face of the pyramid on Mars. And now we have rovers on Mars. Why don't they send the rovers over to check out the pyramid and the face?
Well, Richard, it's a pretty straightforward, simple thing. When Mars Global Surveyor arrived on Mars now, what is it, about 15 years ago, had very super high-resolution cameras. Immediately, one of the very first things that NASA aimed that at was the pyramids, so-called pyramids, and the face on Mars. And we got good high-resolution images there. It's a very interesting geological mesa. It's not a face. It's a mesa. You know, like you see in the Southwest, you see them around Sedona, where you live, all over the place. The red rocks give you these weird shapes, but they're rocks. And that's what the face is. It's not a face. It's a mesa. Now, that doesn't mean you don't want to eventually explore it, but think about it. We want to go where we think water might have been on Mars, and that's not where the mesa is. That's where they sent both Opportunity Spirit and now Curiosity, because they think that Gale Crater, before they landed, they thought Gale Crater once was filled with water. And the evidence from Curiosity says, yes, it was once, and there were streams flowing there. And as they work up the mountainside, where there are cuts that look like washes, they're going to look at those. And this tells you some, not only some of the history, but the possibility of exploring a place where life could have once existed, and maybe, you know, and we haven't found it yet, but maybe still does. You know, one of the mysteries of Mars is the periodic fluctuations of methane in the atmosphere. The ExoMars that's heading there right now is going to be looking very specifically at the methane in the atmosphere, because methane is not something that is long-lasting in an atmosphere. And the fluctuations in the atmosphere at Mars appear, and the data isn't conclusive, but they appear to be seasonal. That suggests some form of activity, could be chemical, but if it's seasonal, if you lean towards biological, microscopic biological,
which is exciting.
So, you know, George asked me, do I believe in extraterrestrial life? Here's an example of the possibility on Mars. We do not have solid evidence. We might eventually, but that's why we go where we're going so far. It's to find, the scientists want to find life on Mars. They want to find out as much as they can, so they're going to the most likely places to find it.
And Robert, even if the face were, let's say, created by some species, you couldn't see it with a rover because it can't get up there. It's too low.
And the truth is, the place to look at it is in orbit. And trust me, after Global Surveyor, they've used Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has even better cameras. And, you know, it's such good cameras that they take pictures of where the rovers are, and you can see the rovers, the dots, and you can see its tracks. So it's really seeing well, and it's taken additional pictures, and it's a mesa. It's not a face. It's not an alien structure. None of them are. Cydonia on Mars is not alien structures. I'm sorry. I know a lot of your listeners want to believe in it.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sorry. I don't. They aren't.
Well, this is your view. That's important.
And I'm basing it on looking at lots and lots of data from Mars. I don't try to, you know, with all the pictures that come down, and I look at them every day, I don't try to see things I want to see. I look at what I see, what's there, and that's how you learn. If you try to imagine something there, you're gonna miss the really exciting thing. That's how at least I look at it.
Next up, we've got Keith in Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Keith, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I've been listening to Robert for many years now, and I just think you're wonderful, Robert.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
I have
my wife.
I have two questions. My first is about the space elevator. I've been hearing about this thing for like 30 years, and I just don't understand how a structure can be constructed to be that tall and stand up and actually be functional. Can you help me with that?
Well, I'm not an engineer, but I have to tell you I have a similar skepticism. But I also will tell you that not being an engineer, I never say never. You know, as Arthur Clarke said, when a scientist tells you impossible, it just means it's a little harder. I think that there is more important engineering technology that we should be focusing on, that we have a better shot right now of actually building, and that we should keep our minds on that kind of engineering, such as cheaper rockets to orbit, building spaceships that can keep people alive in space for years at a time. Those are the kind of things we need to focus on right now, because we can build those and build them effectively. An elevator, a space elevator, may someday be a very effective way to get up and down cheaply from space. But right now, I don't think it's cost effective, and so I don't really focus on it. I think the engineering challenge there is, you're raising the engineering challenge. We do not have the technology right now to build a structure that would be stable and able to maintain itself at this point in time. I don't think we do. I'm not saying it can't be done. I just don't think we have the capability yet.
What about propulsion? They've been talking about getting to Mars in a day or something like that. I mean, is that possible?
Well, you know, my answer is going to be yes, but not maybe right now. I mean,
that's amazing.
Well, here's the deal. Let's talk about a variety of ways to do it within technology that's possible right now. And I'll come at this in two directions. Direction number one is the engines you could use. We use conventional rocket engines right now, and it takes, and we use orbital mechanics with those rockets, and it usually takes about 6 months. And you have to wait until the planets are aligned properly to launch. If you were to use ion engines, such as the spacecraft Dawn has used to go to Vesta and Cirrus in the asteroid belt, you have a much greater flexibility. You can travel in many different places, and the fuel is extremely efficient, so you have a lot of it for very little weight. But you can't go very fast. It takes time because it has a very low acceleration. It's a very low thrust. There's a third engine type ability, which is nuclear engines. And this is a case where you use the heat of a nuclear engine to turn hydrogen into ions. And then just like an ion engine, the hydrogen molecule atom breaks apart, and it is flung out the back of the rocket. You take water and literally break it apart, and the ions fly away, and that produces a much greater thrust, like an ion engine, but it can go much faster. And with an engine like that, yes, you could get to Mars much faster. So that's one way to speed up the trip with technology that's available right now that we wouldn't take much to develop. In fact, the Russians are working on one right now. We worked on a nuclear engine back in the 60s and did great development, and we could really use it. We could really pick up on that and make it work. Now let's approach from the other end. I've actually was at a talk, American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics talk, in which a student had worked out that, you know, with the right kind of acceleration using that kind of those kind of engines, you literally, orbital mechanics can be used to get to Mars in a week, easily, because you just have to pick the right orbital path, and if you have that solid acceleration that a nuclear engine can give you, you can get to Mars in a week.
Yeah.
So this is not impossible, and it's within reach of technology that we already have prototypes for right now. So this is not something far down the road. We might be talking several decades. Once again, I always say, if profit is a motive, it will happen very fast, especially if people are competing to great.
What about commercial aircraft? What about getting from L.A. to New York in 40 minutes?
Well, you see, this is an interesting thing. If you have a suborbital spacecraft that can get into space, such as Blue Origin's New Shepard ship for tourism, that's a craft that can now travel quite a distance in a very short period of time. Similarly, and Virgin Galactic, I don't talk about them much these days because I've kind of gotten tired of the promises without the production, but there is possibilities with that kind of craft as well. You can turn that into a there's technology that can be applied to supersonic and hypersonic travel that will make it possible to maybe get around the Earth faster, not to go into space, but just to get from point A to B. And that's technology that I expect we're going to see more of. It's going to happen. They tie together because there's money to be made, then people are going to try to make the money, and that's a good thing.
Gravity waves. They're saying Einstein's right.
Oh, yes, gravity waves is a cool story. The LIGO experiment found its first gravity wave. I've written about this for astronomy in the past in Sky Intel. It's really pushing the envelope of engineering, science engineering, to develop an observatory that could see the gravity wave. So just to explain what the gravity wave is, you've got a imagine you're having a beach ball floating on the ocean right near the beach with waves going by. The beach ball represents the Earth, and the ocean surface is space itself in a two-dimensional form, and waves go by, and the beach ball bounces up and down. Well, that's essentially what Einstein predicted and what gravity waves are. Space itself ripples when you have a really energetic event happening someplace else, and it produces ripples or waves that flow out, ripples in the fabric of space. They're very minuscule and difficult to measure, but if you have the technology, and we are getting the technology, you can see them, and we actually finally saw one in September. And they have a test spacecraft now, LISA Pathfinder, the Europeans launched, right in orbit right now, just launched, where they're testing technology to be able to put gravity wave detectors in space. And then you have the possibility of a much higher resolution instrument that can see gravity waves of much greater sensitivity. And that's coming down the road. That'll happen sometime.
How did Einstein know this 100 years ago?
Well, how did he know it? Well, what he did is he came up with a theory, And he based his theory on the facts available to him. And he had a very brilliant mind who was able to think outside the box.
I think if he had a computer, Robert, he would have been doing some amazing things.
Maybe, maybe not. You know, a computer can actually be a hindrance because you depend on it too much. He used his brain. And I think that it's very important for young people today to recognize that the computer is a tool, but it's only a tool. If you let it do your work for you, like graphics is a good example. On a computer, you can do amazing things with the graphics program. But can you take a pen and actually draw someone's face? That's a skill that's needed to understand mm-hmm. how to draw on a computer. And so you gotta be aware of these things. So I'm not so sure Einstein would have been helped by a computer. These are, of course, speculation.
Go up to a kid without a calculator and ask them to subtract 53 from 312 and see what they come up
with.
Yes,
and this is important. You should be able to do that math if you want to. If you want to build spaceships, you use your calculator because it's fast. It saves you time. But if you want to have some intuitive understanding of what those equations are doing, you should be able to do the math as well in your head.
Let's go to Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida now. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
I don't like professional astronomers. Really hate them. And the reason I hate them so much is when I watch television and read about them is they never seem to see or acknowledge the existence of UFOs. And they never photograph them. In other words, they run these billion-dollar telescopes and we never see a UFO. How come there are millions of these pictures, videos taken constantly, and yet when you get to this group of professional astronomers, they always say if they don't exist, they're Venus, or this, or that. They lie through their teeth. I'm very angry about this because my taxpayers' money is paying for these things, and they make it believe that these things do not exist.
Well, I'm not sure you're asking the right guy, Robert.
Well, look, let's be...
Save that for another one, Mike, but go ahead,
First
Robert.
First of all, astronomers are not looking for UFOs, and the instruments they build, the telescopes they build, are expressly not designed to see such things because they're designed to look at very faint objects very far away. And if UFOs, unidentified flying objects, are in the atmosphere of the Earth, flying around the Earth, let's say it's a flying saucer, let's say it's an alien spacecraft, it's going to be incredibly bright and moving very fast, and it's not going to be in that field of view even long enough to see or be in focus. It would be like something moving across the lens, a dust speck in front of the lens of your camera when you're trying to take a picture. You won't see it. They'll see something. They won't know what it is, and it's just there'd be no evidence, so they couldn't say. Secondly, I think the caller's making a mistake to say they lie through their teeth or they never say. Most good astronomers are like me. They're not going to say, oh, they don't exist. They're going to say, we haven't gotten solid evidence that we trust.
And we're coming back with final questions for you, Mr. Zimmerman, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Robert Zimmerman, our very special guest who has been so gracious to stay in 3 hours today taking your calls here, and we'll get right to them. Robert, what's next on your plate? What are you up to?
Oh, I'm right now working on a policy paper. For a think tank in Washington, D.C. about the American space program. I can't talk much more about it than that, but it'll come out in late May, and it's going to, I think, make significant waves in D.C. about the issues that I talked about early in the show. Wake up some of those thick-headed elected officials to do things a little bit smarter. We have a gigantic debt and deficit, and we should start to recognize we have to use our brains. We can't just simply, you know, spend money wildly. We have to think about it and make intelligent choices. And that's what I'm working on right now.
Okay, let's go now to Jeffrey in Alta Loma, California. He's been on hold for a while. Jeffrey, thank you. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen, and good morning.
Morning.
Morning. I appreciate what Robert said about drawing and computers. As a 56-year-old architect, when CAD came in, I kind of got lost without having my pencil. But anyhow, that's not the point. I was calling the four gas giants in our solar system. Are all of them made up of the same elements, And do you think any of them are proto-stars, kind of like what happened in 2010?
Well, okay, first of all, we vaguely know that they're not exactly all the same. It's one of the reasons they look different.
Right.
But, you know, once again, we've never had an orbiter around either Neptune or Uranus, so our knowledge about those two is somewhat limited. Just a simple flyby, it's not a lot of information. And, you know, long-distance viewing tells you some things, but, you know, these are big objects, so our knowledge is limited about all of them, but they are made up of somewhat different chemicals. That's why they look different. As for are they protostars? No, Jupiter has been called by some once in a while a failed star, and that's even an overstatement. But essentially, it when it accumulated mass from the original disk that formed the solar system, it didn't get quite enough to turn itself into a star. You know, you asked me, George, earlier in the show about why is there molten cores.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that heat, you get enough mass together, you start to produce radioactive heat in the center. You get enough mass together, it puts enough pressure in the internal core of an object to produce nuclear reactions, and that's a star. Jupiter didn't quite get that big. It got big enough that the radioactivity within its core, it's trapped there, and it produces enough heat that it actually produces more heat that the planet emits than it absorbs. So the sun brings so much heat in, but the planet emits more heat because of the heat produced by the reactivity in its core. It's not a star, but it does that. The other gas giants were not even close. No, so a star is a much bigger object by far.
Could we wake up in the morning and see activity on the sun pointing to its, soon-to-be exploded sun? Something could happen. Something could go awry.
Not likely. Very unlikely. Extremely unlikely. I mean, think about it. The sun has been burning pretty constantly, has slight variations, but we're talking about very tiny variations relative to its brightness. Billions of years, and it's hard to imagine how long that time is. We've only been tracking the solar cycle now for about 250 years, and so we see some fluctuations in its brightness, but we're talking about 0.01% variations within the solar cycle every 11 years in terms of its brightness. I'm not talking about a lot. The understanding of stellar evolution is not complete, but it's pretty solid, and we understand the atomic processes going on there reasonably well. The sun is not likely to change drastically for a very long time. It's got enough hydrogen and helium fuel to burn steady as it is for more than a billion years. I don't know the exact number that has been calculated, but it's pretty reliably. We don't have to worry. It's not going to explode into a supernova.
Even the slightest deviation, this is what's so remarkable about all this, Robert. I mean, even if the sun increased its temperature by 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is seems like nothing, it would play havoc with us, wouldn't it?
That's true. You're absolutely right there. This is where I talked about earlier, the solar cycle. The known variation between, because we've only been studying with good equipment and space-based data, we've only been studying the variations of the solar cycle since the late 70s. So we only have like 3 or 4 solar cycles of good data about the variations of the sun. But from that data, we know that the sun does vary very slightly over the course of that 11-year solar cycle. It gets slightly brighter when the sun is very active and has lots of sunspots, and gets slightly dimmer when it has very few sunspots and is not active. Difference is tiny. It's very important to understand that. The cold little ice age that occurred in the 1600s when we had our last grand minimum, when there was no sunspots and therefore the sun was slightly dimmer for a long period of time, that cold could not have been produced by the variations we've so far detected. Yet there is a link between the solar cycle and the climate. When the sun isn't active, the Earth gets colder. And so there is some process that appears to be happening that is maybe not tied to the actual brightness of the sun, but affects the Earth. One of the theories is that when the sun isn't active, more cosmic rays can get into the inner solar system. They hit the upper atmosphere, and they produce more clouds. And more clouds blocks more sunlight, which is why the Earth gets colder. That's one theory that has been backed by some sunlight. In terms of the sun, you know, George, we have never actually, with good instruments, studied a grand minimum. It's very possible if the sun goes through a grand minimum again in the next solar cycle, and that could happen. It's possible. Some solar scientists believe it might happen. We might discover that during a grand minimum, the variation is more than we expected. Mm-hmm. And that could be, and like you say, it's 5 degrees. It doesn't have to be even 5 degrees.
No.
A degree or half a degree would be significant, would do significant changes to the Earth's climate. And I must point out something that I've said repeatedly on Behind the Black and in articles in many places, that we should be much more afraid of cooling than warming. If it gets warmer, what happens then is you probably have longer crop seasons, more agricultural regions that can grow food. It's probably to our benefit. Plant life, trees actually prospers from that.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets colder, you can't grow crops. That's what happened in the Little Ice Age. You had summer years without any summer, failed crops, starvation, famine. And so we should be much more concerned about cooling. We don't know if that's going to happen, but we should be aware of that possibility without doubt.
La Nina, El Nino and La Nina.
Yes.
Key is a warming and a cooling, right?
A sense. Well, it's complicated. It's more complicated than that. La Nina, El Nino, I should say, is a warming across the equator in the Pacific.
They bring rain and everything else.
That's right. That warming in the Pacific, because the Pacific is so large, produces effects throughout the globe, including more rain in California. We're just going through a very weak El Nino, very weak one. But the result is that California is beginning to get more rain. The drought's going to end, and that's a good thing. There were predictions by global warming doomsdayers that the global warming was going to produce big El Ninos. Well, we had one in 98. It's now been almost 20 years. There hasn't been anything close to it since. And they keep predicting a big one, and the last two predictions were total flops. They were very weak. El Niño, La Niña is a cold Pacific, and it produces different global effects. The climate is really complicated. We have only begun to scratch the surface of an understanding of it. And so people understand where I'm coming from. I'm not denying global warming or climate change. I'm pointing out that anyone who claims the science is settled here is lying. We don't really yet understand all the ramifications of what's going on. And that we should be aware of that and keep a very clear and open mind, because we don't really have enough data to understand what's happening.
John in Portland, Maine. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah. Long-time listener.
Well, thank you.
Keeping notes all the time. Let me get to the one page. I had two questions, one short, one long. I've been telling people about this little ice age, and, well, you know how that goes about, you know, telling people about stuff like that. Have either of you heard of or seen of the movie Moonwalkers?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with it offhand. As you say, I'm slow about modern culture at times.
Okay, it's a lot of fun. I'll put it that way. At the same time, or same, you know, question marks, have you, Robert, heard of the supposed 100 satellites in Earth's orbit, 50 pointed at us and the others outwards into space? And this could be a question for another show at another time, but it seems appropriate. Thanks.
Actually, I'm not sure I understand that question, to be very honest.
And let me ask you this, Robert. Have you heard of the Black Knight satellite, which is a strange story that people think this satellite might be thousands of years old that's been orbiting our planet?
Nope, I haven't heard that one, George.
Okay. I'll have Lisa send you some stuff.
Yeah, sure. Send me some stuff.
Look it up for us.
You know me. I'm really like to have solid data. send me the stuff. Let me put it that way. I don't know about it, so I'd like to know more. I'm quite willing to admit ignorance about something. That's not something I'm ashamed of.
That's fair enough. That is fair enough.
Yeah.
How come there aren't more planets in the solar system? Why did they stop?
Well, you know, that's a question that a lot of astronomers who study exoplanets right now are trying to answer. And you can't really answer the question yet because we don't really have a clear survey of what solar systems are like. We have, one of your callers correctly noted, we have a very biased sample of solar systems right now because we've only been collecting the data for 20 years, not quite. And that data sample is biased by the instrumentation we use to look. It tells us some things, but it misses others. And so to understand why our solar system is the way it is, or any solar system the way it is going to require a lot more knowledge. It's going to require, just like I'd like to get to the rest of the planets in the solar system, it's eventually going to require us to travel to other stars and begin to really explore the entire galaxy. And sadly, George, I won't be around when that happens, but eventually I have total faith it will. Humans are very clever, and they will make such things happen.
Angel is in Galveston, Texas now. Hey, Angel, go ahead.
Yes, hi, how are you? I'm very happy to be on your show. I'm here pushing 2,300,000 barrels of, or gallons of crude here in the ICW. I'm calling to see if you guys remember that game that they used to play. It was where the lunar module used to land on the moon. And, you know, I associate that with my job every day when I'm maneuvering these big 350-foot barges. The other thing that I wanted to mention was about this pulsating technology that they're talking about to be able to go to Mars with a big sail. I'll go off the air with that. And thank you.
All right. Well, first of all, I remember, yes, the lunar module simulator game, and I was terrible at it. I never landed. Neil Armstrong did not want me his pilot.
No.
Every time. As for I'm now blanking. What was that? Oh, solar sails. Solar sails are a very viable and very clever idea that we have not taken advantage of.
Taking the solar wind, right?
Yeah, essentially sail the wind. And it's absolutely a great concept. It could be used for a lot of purposes. And we have not grasped at it. And once again, this gets back to, you know, you ask for a government agency to do things, and it doesn't like risks, so it tends not to do innovative, creative things. And so we haven't done innovative, creative things for many decades. I think that is changing, thank goodness, and we're going to start to see some really creative, interesting things happening in the next few decades. And one of them is solar sails. I mean, there have been, the Planetary Society has, those members have donated a great deal of money to develop solar sail prototypes and launch them. They've had bad luck. In fact, the whole solar sail industry has had routinely bad luck getting their solar sails into orbit to test them. The Japanese have put one up that they tested successfully, and it was flying for several years in the solar system, and they were just seeing how it worked, and that's what you have to learn how to do. I think down the road we're going to be using that technology a lot more.
Let's take another call or two. Michael in San Diego now. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if my father used to build the F1 rocket engines for the Saturn V, which were the bottom stage, the whole thing off the ground. And he once told me that they had built 65 of those engines that were never used. I was wondering what your guests would think about that and what he thinks he might use them for someday.
I couldn't quite understand what he asked. Was he talking about his father was in the Russian or the American space program?
American
space program. These were engines, yeah. Rocket engines.
Unused engines.
I'm not familiar. I don't think there's any American engines like that that have not been used, not in that quantity. You might be confusing this with Russian engines left over from the Soviet era that we actually were buying. Orbital's ATK was buying them and installing them in its Antares rocket. These were refurbished Russian engines from the 60s. They had like several.
Those were huge, weren't they?
It's not so much that we used. They were actually very clever designed engines. They were good designed engines, but they were 40 plus years old, and they were refurbished. And that is one of the reasons, that was the reason why the Antares rocket exploded a year and a half ago, and why they're no longer using that particular, those engines. They have them, but they're not going to use them. They're instead buying new engines because, you know, used parts in a rocket, you know, I'm all for, reusable rockets, but rockets that are engines that have been sitting for 40 years unused and then you refurbish, you're asking for trouble. And so that may be what your call is thinking of.
Robert, as we look at the advances in space and where we're headed, what about warfare and taking out satellites by nations that, want to go to war?
It is actually a concern from a military perspective because satellites are important if we are at war. They provide us a great surveillance and reconnaissance. They're the best way to get that information. But satellites are very fragile, and it's very difficult to protect them. And it's actually relatively easy to send up an anti-satellite vehicle to destroy satellites. So that is a concern. But I would say that you can't outlaw it. You can't pass rules in the UN to say no one will build such a thing. That just won't work.
Someone's going to build it.
They're going to do it. I mean, North Korea is not going to obey any of these things. Iran is not going to obey them. They break UN resolutions at will continuously. In just the last month, I've reported on Behind the Black, them breaking UN relations, both countries, UN resolutions. So you can't outlaw it. What you have to do is face reality, and deal with it and prepare against it. And the U.S. military is actually thinking along these lines right now. How can we prepare? Many ways to do that. Obviously, redundancy is the best way, I think, in space. Don't depend on one satellite. Have a lot of satellites.
You got it. Robert, thanks for being on the program. His website, behindtheblack.com. I'm coming back for an hour of open lines on Coast to Coast AM.